Hi, I'm Bhante Sujata, and we're here this morning to bring you some Dhamma from the Samaditti Sutta, the Discourse on Right View. So I'll just start out by giving a bit of background into the text that we're going to be using for the next few sessions. So this is the Samaditti Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 9, the Discourse on Right View. And being located in the first 10 suttas of the Majjhima Nikaya is somewhat significant. In the Buddhist suttas, almost always the texts or the collections are structured in groups of 10 entities, 10 suttas or 10 vinaya rules or something like that. And that group of 10 is called a wagga. And those waggas are actually quite significant. They were important organizing units that the redactors of the canon used almost universally across all Buddhist scriptures in order to place things together. And so the fact that this first wagga, this first group of 10 suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya is placed at the beginning there is an indication that this was felt to be a group of suttas which was very significant and regarded as very important. And from this, I think we can probably infer that those students in the past who were studying the Dhamma, especially those who were studying the Majjhima Nikaya, would probably start with this group of 10 suttas, which cover actually a lot of the really important themes of the Dhamma. And we find that a lot of the suttas in that group of 10, such as the Sabbasava Sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, the Watthuppama Sutta, and so on, that these give a lot of the very important basic teachings of the Dhamma. And one of those, of course, being the Samaditti Sutta, Discourse on Right View. And Right View, a foundational topic for the whole of Buddhism, the first factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And within, again, if we consider, just briefly to consider the structure of the Buddhist scriptures, what we usually find is that the basic teachings, important teachings of the Dhamma, are presented countless times, right, throughout all the suttas. So, for example, something like Right View might be mentioned hundreds of times in the different discourses. But usually when it's mentioned in brief, right? And occasionally it might be explained in a bit more detail. And then there might be a few places where it's explained in quite a lot of detail, as it is in this sutta. So this is one of the ways that the suttas work, right? They present the detailed explanation only in one or two places, but whenever you see the brief explanation, then you're supposed to understand it in terms of that expanded explanation. So this is one of the functions that this discourse has, is it gives us a detailed explanation of right view. So whenever we encounter the idea of right view in the suttas, we have some idea of what it's actually talking about. Now it's quite also interesting and significant that this particular discourse is presented by Venerable Sariputta rather than being presented by the Buddha. And in fact, this is one of the roles that Venerable Sariputta, the Buddha's great disciple and the foremost in wisdom, had within the Buddha's dispensation. That his speciality, that one of the things that he was an expert at, was taking the teachings that the Buddha had given and then giving a very detailed explanation of those things. And we find a number of places and suttas where he does that thing, and in fact is praised by the Buddha for his skill in doing that. So even though this discourse is not spoken by the Buddha himself, it's the next best thing. Okay, so what I'll do as we're proceeding with this talk this morning and with the subsequent talks as we go on is that I'll read out section by section from the sutta, and then we can have a bit of explanation, a bit of discussion. And you know, I'd just like to encourage you to just come up with any questions, sensible ones or silly ones. Actually, interesting thing about the suttas is that almost every sutta that's of some length, right, apart from the very short ones, almost any lengthy sutta is given in a series of question and answers. Yeah? And so, you know, you can imagine that environment in the early Buddhism when the Buddha was there and the early Sangha and so on was not an environment where it was just a one-way delivery of teachings. But almost everything, right from beginning from the second discourse, the Anattalakkhana Sutta, and where the Buddha starts, says, well, what do you think, Master? Is form permanent or impermanent? Oh, well, it's impermanent. Well, is impermanent suffering or pleasurable? And so right from the beginning, the Buddha was engaging and trying to encourage people to respond. And as we know, I think, from modern education standards, that's actually how people learn, right? And we all know that you don't actually learn very much by sort of just sitting and passively listening for long periods of time, but we learn by engaging with things. So just one more bit of background on this particular text. We'll be reading from the Pali, the translation of the Pali text, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya, and the translation is by Bhikkhu Bodhi in his excellent and justly becomes a standard translation, the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, actually originally translated by Venerable Nyanamoli, an English monk, and then retranslated and edited and by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So we'll be using this as our basic translation. You can find it here, or there'll be various translations available online as well. And this particular sutta, although we're going to be working from the Pali version, this sutta has a number of parallels. It has two parallels in the Chinese canon and one partial parallel in Sanskrit. So these parallel suttas are texts which are almost the same as the Pali text that we're dealing with, but which are based on a slightly different Indian original text. The Chinese ones taken to China, usually around the 4th, 5th century, and translated there. So I won't go into detail into the comparative study, but as is usual with this, we find that the differences between the different versions are almost all very slight, very trivial. There's a few structural differences where perhaps one section might be in one place in the Pali and it's in another section in the Chinese or something like that. So a few minor editing changes like that. And there's only one variation of substance that I'm aware of between the two texts, and one or two variations of substance which I'll mention when we come to them. But for the most part, the Chinese texts are pretty much the same as the Pali. So, let's begin with the sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Sarvati in Jetta's Grove in Atapindika's Park. And there the Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Friends, bhikkhus." "Friend," they replied. The Venerable Sariputta said this, One of right view is said, "Friends. In what way is a noble disciple one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma?" And the monks replied, "Indeed, friend, we would come from far away to learn from the Venerable Sariputta the meaning of this statement. It would be good if the Venerable Sariputta would explain the meaning of this statement. Having heard it from him, the bhikkhus will remember it. Then, friends, listen and attend closely to what I shall say." "Yes, friend," the bhikkhus replied, "the Venerable Sariputta said this." So then he goes on to the first section. Okay, so this is the introductory portion, and obviously follows a similar format to we find in the introductions to many of the other suttas. But there's a few interesting details here which kind of strike me when I'm reading this. First thing is it begins by saying the Buddha's living in Sarvati, and then switches straight away to having, and then the Venerable Sariputta said this, yeah? Which is a little bit kind of unusual, right? But anyway, it suggests that perhaps it doesn't actually say where the sutta is set, really, does it? Well, I suppose it says there, Venerable Sariputta, so it sort of implies that he's at Sarvati as well. So I guess he's probably at Jetta's Grove as well. But certainly, one of the things we know is that the Buddha didn't monopolize all of the teaching. Right? He wasn't like a kind of jealous Dhamma thing, you know? He wasn't like trying to control and stop everyone else from speaking. In fact, he would always encourage people to speak on the Dhamma. And it's one of the nice things about Buddhism is that there's always this kind of encouragement and respect to make that effort. And I think that's something that's good to learn and to remember, because sometimes we feel intimidated to maybe speak about Dhamma and so on. But it's always a good thing. And you learn a lot by trying to speak about it. Another minor point on the dialogue, you notice how that Sariputta is talking to the monks and refers to them as friend, and they refer back to him with the same word, friend, right? Now, of course, they're not saying friend because they're not speaking in English, but they're saying avuso, right? And so avuso is a Pali word, which actually is a bit more respectful than friend. Friend is not quite, it's difficult to capture all the nuances of the different titles and things in Pali and English. I mean, we don't really use friend as a term of address anyway in English, but arvoso, actually the root of arvoso is the root ayu, which means age, right? So actually the root of it is elder. And so it's actually kind of a bit more respectful than just friend. But the interesting thing is that they're mutually referring to each other by the same title. And so this is something which you find all the way through the suttas. And then there's a kind of curious episode right at the end of the Buddha's life in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta where he said that the junior monks should refer to the senior monks as venerable or bhante, and then the seniors refer to the juniors by abuso or by just their name. Right? So this idea that you have more of a kind of a hierarchy in terms of the titles and the language that you use. And so that's a kind of interesting detail, but you see, you know, within the Sangha, there's quite a flat kind of culture. Right? I mean, obviously you had like respect for the senior teachers like Sariputta and so on, but generally speaking within the Sangha, any bhikkhu or any bhikkhuni who's ordained is a fully fledged member of the Sangha, and and they have just as much say in all of the Sangha business and all of those kinds of things. And the general idea is that the seniors and those are regarded as somebody who's to be respected, so their voice is to be listened to. So like say if you have an assembly, then the elder might be the person who has the right to speak first, right? But actually when it comes to making a decision, everybody's equal. Yeah? So it's a kind of quite a nice balance between that idea of that mutuality of that, on the one hand, the respect for the seniority in the elders, but on the other hand, the recognition that every member of the Sangha at the end of the day is just equal. Yeah. Right view is actually the correct translation rather than right understanding. Yeah, right understanding is a misleading translation. The point here is that a view, like in English, the word view means how you see things, how your opinion about something, your ideas about something. Yeah? And that's a bit different from understanding something, right? So you might have a view about something. But then we have views about all kinds of things that we don't know anything much about, right? And in fact, we often tend to have stronger views about things that we know less about, right? And that tends to be a somewhat embarrassing aspect of human psychology. The more we know about something, the less we hold on to our views about them. It's not always the case, but I think it often tends to be the case. So right view, remember, is the first factor of an overlateral path. Right? So it's not the understanding, it's not the liberation, it's the beginning. It's what we start with. Right? And so that right view is how we think about the Dhamma, what we believe about the Dhamma, right? What our opinions are about the Dhamma. Right? And so that right view is developed and deepened by reading the suttas, by thinking about the Dhamma, by discussing it as we are today. None of which is deep insight into the Dhamma, but it's those things which are moving us towards it. So it's giving us that framework. Yeah? In modern Thai, the word view, in the Sanskrit version of that, is tricity, and it means theory. Right? So you have things like tricity hengan wiwat, which is the theory of evolution. Right? And so, again, that idea that a view is something which is like a set of ideas and concepts which sort of orientate the way that you look at things. So in that sense, that's the basic meaning of right view. Right? In that sense, it's what's getting you started. Yeah? Now, in this particular sutta, it's talking about, it's moving towards the culmination and the perfection of right view. And so this is the question that Sariputta is asking right at the beginning. And that quest, that culmination of right view and the perfection of it refers to the stream enterer. Right? So that refers, the perfection of right view in fact refers to that moment when your ideas become your understanding and become your experience. You know? And so this is where that right view is actually switching to what they call samanyana, is the right knowledge. And that moment when that most profoundly switches is the time of stream entry. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the unwholesome and the roots of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the roots of the wholesome, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, whose perfect confidence in the Dhamma and has arrived at this true Dhamma. And what, friends, is the unwholesome? What's the root of the unwholesome? What's the wholesome? What is the root of the wholesome? Killing living beings is unwholesome. Taking what is not given is unwholesome. Misconduct in sensual pleasures is unwholesome. False speech is unwholesome. Malicious speech is unwholesome. Harsh speech is unwholesome, gossip is unwholesome, covetousness is unwholesome, ill will is unwholesome, wrong view is unwholesome. This is called the unwholesome. And what is the root of the unwholesome? Greed is the root of the unwholesome, hate is the root of the unwholesome, delusion is the root of the unwholesome. This is called the root of the unwholesome. And what is the wholesome? Abstention from killing living beings is unwholesome. Abstention from taking what is not given, abstention from misconduct and sensual pleasures, abstention from false speech, abstention from malicious speech, abstention from harsh speech, abstention from gossip, uncovetousness, non-ill will, and right view. These are all wholesome. This is called the wholesome. And what is the root of the wholesome? Non-greed is the root of the wholesome. Non-hate is the root of the wholesome. Non-delusion is the root of the wholesome. This is called the root of the wholesome. When a noble disciple has thus understood the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, he entirely abandons the underlying tendency to lust. He abolishes the underlying tendency to aversion. He extirpates the underlying tendency to the view and conceit, I am. And by abandoning ignorance and arousing true knowledge, he here and now makes an end of suffering. In that way, too, a noble disciple is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has perfect confidence in the Dhamma, and has arrived at this true Dhamma. Okay, so this section dealing with, obviously, the wholesome and the unwholesome, and these are expressed in a very commonly used framework in the suttas that's called the Dasa Kusala Kama Pata, the 10 pathways of wholesome action, and the 10 pathways, of course, of unwholesome action. So I'll just break this down a little bit. When we're using the translation here, wholesome, this is the rendering that Bhikkhu Bodhi is using based on Nyanamoli's rendering for the Pali word kusala. Yeah? And now, basically, kusala just means good, really. But it has a slightly more sort of Buddhist nuance, right? There's a variety of words we find in the suttas to mean what we call, translate what we would call good in English. We find, for example, the word punya, which we often translate as merit or meritorious. We also find quite commonly the word kalyana in that context. You know, we often translate kalyana as something like beautiful or lovely. But in the suttas, kalyana is kind of quite commonly used in opposition to papa, papa meaning bad or wicked or evil, right? So kalyana va papa kangwa. So there's variety of different words, all having that kind of meaning of something which is good. Now, of those different words, the word kusala has more of a specifically kind of Buddhist kind of nuance, that it doesn't just mean something which is generally considered and regarded as good in the world, but is more specifically means something which is good in the sense of being part of the Eightfold Path and part of what's leading to enlightenment, and part of what is like a skillful use of action in our practice of the Dhamma. Yeah? Now, the literal meaning of the word kusala, in fact, is skillful. Right? And it's used in that way quite commonly in the suttas. You find, for example, like a kusala, a skillful carpenter, or a skillful cart maker, or something like that. And so it just means somebody who's good at their job. Right? And so I actually prefer the rendering skillful and unskillful. For that reason, and it's used by a number of other translators. And to me, that sort of captures something a bit more specific. Wholesome is a bit, to me, a bit vague. And so what the meaning of kusala here is it's more than just good. It means something which is not only good, but something which is in line with the Dhamma, and it's something which has wisdom so that it contributes to developing the Eightfold Path and unraveling dukkha. But also, I think the first, or certainly one of the earliest teachers to consciously and reflectively use language and to understand the particular structures of language and what the nuances of that are in his presentation of the Dhamma. I think this is one of those areas where when we look at the suttas and we go into it more and more carefully, I'm constantly kind of amazed at how careful and how precise those choices of wording are. Now, on one sense, if we look at this particular case, we have greed, hatred, and delusion on one side, and then non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion. And as you so rightly said, then we could easily express all of those things in a positive form, right? So non-greed we could express by renunciation or generosity, non-hatred we could express by loving kindness, non-delusion we can express by wisdom. And of course there are many places in the suttas where it in fact is expressed in that positive form, right? Now, on the one hand, it's a bit of an idiom in Pali that something which is expressed in a negative form has more of a positive force compared to the force that would have, say, in English. Okay, that's one thing. So in terms of the actual meaning of it, you know, you could pretty much just substitute one for the other. And this is what you find, like in things like the Abhidhamma and so on. This is what it'll say. Say non-greed means, you know, letting go and so on. But there is, I think, more to it than that, and I think it's more subtle than that. Basically, the point is that by phrasing what you're saying in a negative, and our lawyers who are present here today will probably be able to confirm this, by phrasing things in a negative, you are a lot safer. Yeah, right. You avoid implicating yourself in things that you don't want to be implicated in. Yeah. Right? Yeah. If you're doing it in a legal context, it would be avoiding being going to jail, right? But from the Buddha's point of view, and from the Buddha, and of course, you know, Sariputta, who has a similar level of subtlety in the way he's expressing things, it's avoiding unwanted philosophical implications of what it is that you're saying. Okay? Now, we could explore that on a number of levels, but on one level, what that might mean, for example, is that if we consider greed, hatred, and delusion, non-greed, non-hatred, non-delusion, right? What about, say, an arahant who's passed away? Yeah? Now, can we say that they have generosity, loving kindness, and wisdom? It's a bit... Well, I'm not quite sure, right? And then we get into all these kind of philosophical questions of what is enlightenment, what is the nature of someone who's passed away, and so on and so forth. But we can obviously say they don't have greed, hatred, and delusion. Right, so once we've expressed it in that negative form, actually, you're a bit more covered. Yeah, it is an interesting thing, and it's an interesting ambiguity in the way that the precept on drinking and alcohol is presented. And there's actually a number of contexts where where you find that there are parallels for the other four of the five precepts. But the fifth precept isn't really paralleled. Another important context of that is in the gradual training, the Anupubhasika, which we find in the Samanyapala Sutta and plenty of other places where it talks in quite detail about different precepts, but then doesn't mention drinking as part of that same list of precepts. Another interesting parallel or partial correspondence is with the four Parajika rules for bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, where the four Parajika rules correspond to a severe breaking of the first four of the precepts, right? So the killing of precept means killing a human being and so on and so forth. So severe breaking of those four precepts is the four Parajika rules. But then there's no one corresponding to the alcohol one. That's actually a much more minor form of offense, a pachitya offense. There is this interesting ambiguity about the place of that rule in there. And I think the reason for that is because if you look at the other precepts, I think that they are things which are more sort of inherently unwholesome and inherently harmful. Whereas I think, say, taking alcohol, firstly, is something which is more personal, right? So it's not something which is necessarily harming others. And it's something which, you know, on a small scale is probably not that much of a problem, right? Someone has a glass of wine, it's not the end of the world, right? But it's there as a precept, I think primarily because, and this is how it's always explained in the tradition, is because it makes you break all the other precepts, yeah? And I think this is the real problem. It's not necessarily that having a glass of wine or two or something is such an evil thing to do, right? But we know overwhelmingly, and it's just so obvious that violence, domestic violence, all of these kinds of things are all increased by taking alcohol. So I think that's perhaps the reason why there's that ambiguity there. Yeah. In the Dhamma, everything is included. Right? Dhamma is fractal. Okay? Everything's included in there, and there's as much detail as you want to see in any particular point of the Dhamma. Right? So, if you're asking, is that enough? Then again, sure, it can be, but the more that we explore, the more that we look, the more we understand, the more we learn, then the easier it is, right, for us to draw that information. Yeah? So the same thing as a lawyer, right? You're investigating a case, yeah? You can look at somebody can tell you a few details about a case and you can reach a conclusion, right? And if you're really smart, sometimes you can reach a conclusion and get it right, just from a few details. Oh, it's obvious so-and-so must be guilty, right? But if you really want to, if you be sure and you really want to go into it, then you want as much information as possible. The counterexample to that, though, is also the fact that too much information is not useful, because too much information stops us from being able to infer, right? We need space in our minds, and if you just keep on bunging stuff into your head all the time, information, 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 you don't have the space to be able to digest it. So these things need to go into a kind of a balance, yeah. And, for myself, when I was studying, when I was a young monk and practicing the Dhamma, and I wouldn't, spend huge amounts of time sort of reading and researching the suttas and so on. I'd do that for periods, right? But most of the time, I would read maybe like one sutta a day. That was my main practice, read one sutta a day, and then, you're doing a few hours of meditation and so on, and then the suttas will really kind of sink in, and the understanding sinks in and they stay there. And so this is why, even many years later, I can still remember so much about the suttas, which sometimes I might not have read it for many, that particular sutta for many years, and I can still remember things about it because it's that space to allow it to settle in. Yeah. So we have this group of 10 dhammas, the 10 ways of wholesome action and 10 ways of unwholesome action. And this is given by Venerable Sariputta as one expression of the way in which a stream enterer has that direct insight into the Dhamma. Now, I'll just briefly run over what these 10 things are. Hopefully most of them are quite familiar to you. So we have, first of all, killing living beings, taking what is not given, and sexual misconduct. Okay, so that's the first three, and that's the first three precepts, okay? So killing living beings essentially means killing or harming anything, even insects and so on. But as explained very often in the suttas, it doesn't just mean not harming, but also means developing loving kindness and compassion for sentient beings as well. So something like a physical object, it has to be removed from its base. Okay, so this is how it's defined. Now, in according to the monk's precepts, to be taken what is not given, for it to be a parajika, so to be an expulsion offence, it has to be something which is of a considerable value, right? Now, how we define considerable value is a bit hard, but probably something that's worth maybe $10, $20 or something like that. It says something which would be for which the king would imprison you. Okay. So it would have to be something which was significant. I would say that the definition is something that's significant enough to actually warrant, legal action. You might give me an opinion on this, but once I asked a lawyer about this, I said, how much does it have to be to warrant legal action? And the answer I got from the lawyer was, well, if it's an Aboriginal kid stealing a lolly, if it's an executive of a big company stealing a few million dollars. But that was maybe a little bit cynical, but perhaps more true than we would like to admit. But do you have any opinion on that? How much do you have to steal before it's considered to be a criminal matter? The Vinaya and the traditional way of handling this notion of theft, it has been overtaken by technology. All right? And of course the fact was in those days you couldn't copy things in that way, right? But now humanity has spent the last 20 years feverishly building copying machines, right? We call them computers, right? And there are billions of them and they're like really, really good at copying stuff, right? So this has now become a huge issue. And it simply didn't exist in that way. So what we've seen with the copyright law is there's been an attempt, and I don't think it's an entirely honest attempt, an attempt by the copyright providers to say that violating copyright is theft. I actually don't think it's theft in that same kind of way. I think it's a different kind of thing, which is not to say that it's right and you should do it. It's to say that it's not quite the same kind of thing as stealing something. Yeah? So to say that you copied it, therefore the value of what somebody's had might diminish, right, is a little bit less direct and a little bit more questionable than to say they actually don't have it anymore, right? So, and this is, of course, the way that this plays out in the real world is quite complex, okay? At one point, I'm not sure if it's still the case, but at one point the most downloaded movie was Avatar, right? Also happens to be the world's most profitable movie. Yeah. So to make that connection between whether you're copying something or diminishing the market value, I think is a bit dubious. I've done a bit of research in this in terms of Buddhist scriptures and translations, and studies have shown that actually the sales and the revenue generated from books usually will increase when they're made freely available on the web. Okay, because more people read them and they want to buy them and so on. So there isn't a one-to-one relationship and simple relationship as there is in the case of stealing something. So this is an area where I would say that copyright downloading and so on, whether something is legal is one matter, whether it's right is another matter, whether it's breaking a precept is another matter. And we have to be clear in our heads about making those kinds of distinctions. It doesn't automatically mean that it fits under one or other of those categories. We should probably break there. We haven't finished discussing this particular section, but I think we're just about running out of time. So maybe we'll continue this section in the next session. Thank you very much once more, and I look forward to seeing you all again next time.